I'm changing my.
I think it's still, we're still waiting for.
Get started. I actually prepared some very nice notes, but I wasn't able to print them out. And I, being Microsoft, I had to start my computer. So. But luckily, I had a people who know me know I had a razor sharp memory. So I think I'm very happy to introduce our speaker, Bob Coke, who's from Oxford University, currently where he leads the Foundations of Computing group currently with Samson Abramsky. Bob got his PhD from Free University of Brussels, and then he did postdocs at Plato College and McGill, and also during that time had was affiliated with the Department of Physics at Cambridge.
Max.
Yeah. Okay, sorry. And versus big. And Bob's research concerns the foundations of, well, it's actually spent kind of spans quantum information and quantum foundations. And he and his co-workers have sort of developed a very nice way of looking at quantum mechanical effects in terms of mathematical constructs such as categories and logic, and I think you might say something about that today. And there, in 2005, there was a very, he gave some lectures and had some lecture notes under the very intriguing title, Kindergarten Quantum Mechanics, where everything is a very simply construct boxes and various shapes, and you draw lines between them, and everything becomes very clear. And I really hope that within, personally, that in the next 3 years it will make it into the curriculum for some personal reasons. And I feel in any event, I can explain how this works and things.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, so I'm mainly doing a little bit of a survey.
Oh, and you should be wearing a microphone. Thank you.
Oh. Same.
Because we're recording.
Switch on.
This we need to not think. Look, stop for me.
Switch on.
Yes. Yes.
Switch on, Bob.
Right. Yes. Yeah. Okay. Okay, so the story starts in 1932 with what could be said the real
end of building the quantum mechanical formalism with Voloman's book, the mathematics looks like the quantum mechanics. As we know, quantum mechanics is very successful. So it's somehow surprising that 3 years after, like, crafting his brainchild, you know, following the book of, I would like to make a confession which may seem immoral, I do not believe absolutely in Hilbert space, no more. A year later, he wrote a paper with that Gary Berkov, who is called, what which is called The Logic of Quantum Mechanics, and some area came out of this to which people refer as quantum logic, and there is many branches of quantum logics, and many attempts followed, and they all failed, because none of this can be found in textbooks. So, meanwhile, we do know a lot of stuff more than von Neumann knew at the time. For example, we know about a lot of new physical phenomena. And I think they're all quite recently, and they have been all discovered in the, what you could call the quantum computing era. And there's a bunch of quantum informatic protocols which really exhibit new capabilities of nature and how we can manipulate nature. And with this, so I'm talking quantum teleportation and then related type phenomena, measurement-based quantum computing, things like that. Meanwhile, there's also new physical insights, and that's the test product plays a key role in quantum theory. I think Schrödinger already realized this in the 30s, but it never was sort of put on the forefront in, definitely not in foundations discussions. All foundations discussions very much focused on the concept of measurement rather than on the tensor structure. Now, meanwhile, in a completely different area of science, there is some new logic discovered, and this is in the area of computer science. Like, computer scientists are very interested in how different systems interact, and it turns out to be much more complicated than you think if you want to have a simple little abstract calculus of, like, concurrent interaction. And so there's a bunch of logics of interactions which came out, and something else which is called linear logic, which is a funky logic in which you cannot copy and delete premises. And those people from quantum information, they immediately sort of hear something resonate there. And now these new kind of logics, they actually came with a new kind of algebra. And these algebra are monoidal categories. And all of this talk will be about that. And something really fancy about monoidal categories is that it's basically a language of pictures. This is a very non-trivial equivalence here, highly non-trivial equivalence. So these were around for much longer than these. So that brings us basically to this talk, which is called Where Logic Meets Quantum in a World of Pictures. I mean, sort of a program which started in 94-ish. Meanwhile, a lot of people, much more than here on the picture, were working on this. The ones on the picture are actually the ones who contributed to things I'm going to talk about. And I was supposed to finish a survey on this yesterday, and I didn't. And maybe I finish it later today. So, but ask for it if you want to read about the stuff I'm talking about. Well, pictures. So when somebody starts talking about pictures and physics, you think, yeah, pictures are a nice illustration. So it's just a different way of writing things down. On the other hand, when you go back to the time of, say, Copernicus, the moment he puts the sun in the middle and the earth around, you could say that in a certain way he was sort of preempting Newton's theory of gravitation. It sort of was a little bit hiding in the geometry. And so I'm asking the question how these pictures I'm going to talk about, are they just merely language or is there something more to it? So I'm going to represent quantum processes in a simple way. This is quantum process F. Then I think of it as having an input, having an output, and this box is actually the process. It's like a flowchart diagram from programming. And if I say first I do process F and then process G, I'm just putting G after F. And if I'm saying I'm doing process F on one system and process G on another system, I'm just putting them side by side. It's just a different way of representing composition and tensor.
Well, is it sort of like a quantum circuit, what you're drawing?
Like you could think of that like that. Just you could think of this as gates and circuits at the moment, yeah. So now, here's a law. You can check this. Like if G, F, K, H are all linear maps, and it's just composition of linear maps, and that's tensor linear maps, now you can check that for linear maps, this equation holds. It's not quite. it's not completely trivial to check this, but it's not something which follows directly from the actions of Hilbert spaces. You have to check it. So let's now transcribe this law in pictures. So this is the left-hand side. You see G after F, which I put here, K after H, which I put here, and then I put them side by side. Right? Now, those were my rules. Now I'm looking to the other side. I put G besides K, G besides K, F besides H, F besides H, and then I put one after the other, and what we see is we get a topology. So this seemingly non-trivial law on Hilbert spaces was implicitly encoded in my pictures. Sort of a surprise, like something you have to prove actually. The moment you start writing this down, you actually get something for free. Something, some rule you don't have to carry around when computing. There's actually much more. So here we saw that there are some laws encoded in these pictures, but these pictures in general, they also essentially simplify computations. I'm not going to go in detail through this example here. You can read about that on this Quant PH paper, but there are certain configurations in linear algebra, like this. These are supposed to be projectors, and it's a little bit like a circuit. And you could actually compute this as a matrix, what it does. And if you suppose that these are 10-dimensional Hilbert spaces, then you're talking like 1,000 by 1,000 type of matrices. But for a specific choice of these projectors, it turns out that you can just read the answer from the picture in terms of certain geometric figures. I'm not going to explain this because this will follow from the construction I'm going to make in this talk. But the main point I want to make here is that there are certain higher geometrical structures within linear algebra. And it turns out that while this might look, or one might think that these are random examples, we actually observe that these geometrical structures support important quantum informatic protocols such as quantum teleportation, entanglement swapping. And you can actually just read the protocols from this higher type of geometry which is living within linear algebras. And what's funny about these structures is this is actually the mathematical structure of a tensor product without the linear algebra. That's basically what these geometries are about. They're really about the tensor. Like what I mentioned before, the tensor is something we start to realize is really key in quantum information. So the aim which we have here is like to put a Hilbert space upside down, rather than first defining vectors and additional vectors, and then constructing the tensor product and say, hey, we only take the tensor product and just ignore vectors, vector addition. We throw all that away, and we see how far we can get. And as it turns out, you can get a whole way. You get very, as far as we can see, we haven't found sort of the end yet, the road of far you can actually get. So the first level, so basically what I'm going to do here in this start is now gradually building to solve something which I could call tensor quantum logic. And at the end, I'm going to give some applications. The applications will be in the area of quantum computing and in foundations where I'm going to show that you can get some insights about non-locality, which is quite concrete stuff. So the first step, so I'm going to sort of start with a very general framework and then just add three little bits of structure, and then I'm going to give the application. So but the first basic level which I call compositional theories. Well, so what is a compositional theory? So let A be a router tape. Well, then A admits many states, like it can be dirty, it can be clean, it can be skinned. And now we want to process A into cooked potato B. Now B also admits many states, like boiled, fried, deep fried, all the stuff. And we now are, I mentioned the word process here. So since I used the word, I have to represent my process in a certain way. I'm going to represent my process of turning A into B, say by boiling, in this way. So I'm going to turn A into B by boiling it. That's how I denote this. And this is turning A into B by frying, and this turning A into B by baking. So those are my processes. Right. Now, it turns out that I've been mentioning state, and state is actually some kind of process. Because basically, you know, like for example, this could be, say, raw potato. And this process would then be the production of raw potato. How you produce it, you don't really care. Or you probably grow it somewhere in the ground, but it doesn't really matter. So we don't specify it. That's for the state. The state is a preparation procedure. They don't really care where it comes from. We know that we have everything available. So state is also a process in that sense. Now, I'm introducing a new notion, which is the circle, and I call this a composite process. And this, in this case, I'm first boiling and then salting. And I also can introduce a process of doing nothing. And you see, if I compose doing nothing with something, I'll take the same thing. And next, if you want to do cooking, you probably want to use more than one ingredient. So you need a notation to write down that you actually have two ingredients. So here, if we've got like a potato and a carrot, to denote that they're both available, we just put this symbol between them. It's just a symbol, it's nothing more. All right, and then we can do the same thing. We can put a symbol between boiling and frying, which means that we're boiling a potato while frying the carrot.
Can you be a bit more explicit about saying what the symbols are? Because that green is very pale on the screen.
Oh, I
mean, it's very difficult to read. It's going to be.
At this stage, it's pale something, pale something. Doesn't really matter. I actually use the tensor symbol, but it doesn't matter. Just a symbol to say they're both here.
But you might.
Like, you just can't. People can't. Maybe can't see it very
and,
well.
And,
no?
And if people are going to watch this on the video as well,
you can't both, see this.
Yeah.
This you can't see. It's always the same.
The times with circle around.
Yeah, I mean, I can see it, but I'm thinking when it shows up on the video for people who are watching this in person afterwards, it'll be completely impossible.
I can't change it now. So anyway, the total process is a bunch of these. Did I say everything? I guess so. Eh? So okay. So yeah. So so this is like boiling while, and here is another one which I call meshing. When I mesh, I start from two things and I end up with one thing because it's not like two separate entities anymore. So such a process would look like this. So we would have this side. And so I can put them all together. So this is the process of making carrot potato mesh. And what I call a side is a composition strip structural process because you see, I first do this, then I do this, then I do this. There's some sort of composition structural process. And a law, or more concrete, a law governing recipes arises when I've got two recipes, like two of these things, and they end up being equal. Meaning, I have two ways of doing things, and the result is the same. Although the way of putting things together might be different. So here is one law governing recipes, which says that boil potato and then fry the carrot is the same as fry the carrot and then boil the potato. Right. It's a law, it's this one. So you see, it's a non-trivial equation. And this is actually, it turns out, that you can prove that one from one we've seen before. This one we saw before in the pictures, you remember? And this says, boiled potato, then salt potato, while fried carrot, then pepper carrot. And this is the same. You have to think a little bit, boiled potato, while fried carrot, and then salt potato, while pepper carrot. It's non-trivial equation. It holds. It's a law. Right. So conceptually, what I've been, I did this on purpose, this cooking, because I've given the same talk and then I refer to physical process and then people get really confused because they see the tensor product. And that a physicist just can't see this symbol without thinking that there is like Hilbert spaces and everything around. Like this was obviously not the case here. There were no Hilbert spaces around. But I can tell the same story. So conceptually, we have a theory of systems, which were all the blue things, of processes, which were all the red things. And we can compose them in two ways. There were two ways of composing. One process after the other, or the two processes like in parallel. So while and after, you could say. Algebraically, this is a symmetric monoidal category. That's what it is. So I'm giving you just a definition. That's what it is. Graphically, so this is a highly non-trivial result from 91. That the graphical calculus for symmetric monoidal categories is such that an equation statement between expressions in the language of symmetric monoidal categories holds even only if it's derivable in the graphical calculus. Now, this graphical calculus has sort of gave you the intuitions already of these boxes. So it's a very simple thing. It turns out to capture a highly non-trivial, like the proof of this thing is horrible. Just tell this. It is not easy. Okay, so basically we're talking two equivalent. I wouldn't say equivalent. I think one is better than the other, so they are not equivalent. The pictures are the real maths, I would say. Because you saw that there are these equations which you have to state symbolically, which you don't have to stay for pictures because you get them for free. And there are more than the ones I showed. So in a way, they're not really equivalent, they're equivalent formally, but one is really better than the other. That's the way you should think about it. So what is the data? I'm just going to summarize. So the data we have is such a symmetric model category of systems. There's processes. We have a notion of compound system. This is actually, this was the nothing system, which I used to describe preparation. So the nothing system has a special property. You take any system and you cancel it with nothing. You just have the system you start with. It's nothing. And then we have this temporal notion of composition doing one after the other. And we have identities. This is the definition of symmetric model category. If you add your intuition of processes to it, because otherwise you should write a bunch of equations. But with the intuition of this, this equation is quantum free. So I already represented set that here, this is how we represent the process. This is the identity, composition, and tensor again. Like you might want to sort of swap processes, so you could introduce other stuff. This is actually symmetry in the definition of symmetric nodal category. It means you can swap things. There is such a swapping map. It's a process swapping. Now, where the physics is starting to come in is when I put these words down, states, effects, and quantities. So given that I have this nothing symbol, I can have boxes which go from nothing to something. Right? And nothing will graphically be represented by nothing. So obvious, you just don't represent it. So here, this is from something to nothing, so from something to nothing. And if you compose something from nothing to something, something from something to nothing, you get something from nothing to nothing. Right? And you laugh with this, but these are things you know. Like you know this guy. Right? So I close this and I get this triangle. You know this guy. Close this and I get this triangle. You know this guy. I close this and I get this triangle. So basically these things here was Dirac notation. Nothing but Dirac notation that you've been seeing here. But of course, we got a more richer framework because we can put things side by side and after each other. In the representation, you have to put everything on the line. Yeah?
So on the one hand, you've got this thing that normally one thinks of as the inner product, right?
Yeah.
The bracket. And you're saying that's somehow something you associate with the mapping from nothing to nothing?
Yeah. So the reason for that is that it's like a very, it's a subtle technical point, but if you take a linear map from C to see any linear map, then it's completely determined by what you map the number 1 to, by linearity. So any linear map from C to C corresponds with a single complex number. Similarly, any linear map.
So when you get a scalar, you sort of see that.
I see this as a linear map, which
okay.
So okay. It's just, you want everything at the level of maps. You don't want vectors anymore. So what that shows is, so you can't really throw away these vector spaces and just think of the spaces of linear maps from the complex numbers to a certain yoga space. So everything is now in terms of maps.
Is there a one-to-one map between psi and a, or can you get the same a from different psi's?
No. A is like the Hilbert space, and you want to think of it, this as a vector. So there are many psi's for a given a. It's many preparation procedures. So a is a type of system. So it's like I said, type of system would be electron. Psi is the state. So that's why I'm using the symbols. Right. So we're going to now gradually add a little bit of quantum structure to all these things. And I need a tiny bit more before I can start doing the hardcore stuff. Like here, I sort of represented the inner product. But the inner product is between states, between two states, not between a state and an effect. So we need a way to turn an effect into a state to be able to compute the inner product. So we need adjoint. We introduce something which is an adjoint. And in picture language, it just means you take a picture and you put it upside down. So we add this first new operation to our structure. Whenever you have a box, you allow yourself to put it upside down. So there is another box which corresponds to the upside down thing. So mainly, in symbolically, it means whenever I put an F from A to B, there is a special F from B to A, which in some way relates to it. That's the edge one. Now, from just introducing this, you actually get already quite a rich language of the sort of words you find in your quantum mechanical textbook. Unitarity just means that if you compose this guy with this edge, then you get the identity. That's what unitarity means. Because a unitary map, if you a map is unitary, the edge one is the inverse, right? So if you compose it with the edge one, you get identity. So unitarity can be expressed as like we said, we already have the unit product, because now we have these edge ones here. And other things, like you can prove that from unitarity it follows that you preserve the unit product. You can define self-adjoint projective. You can define what it means to be positive. And this I'm not going to go in because it is a little bit more complicated. This is due to a guy called Peter Selinger. But you basically can already identify completely positive maps and you get choice theorem for free. We have nothing more than this. So in each such theory, you have a notion of completely positive map and choice theory, which in a specific case of looking at linear map, then gives you your usual notion of completely positive map. So you get quite a bit rich language already, but not enough actually. So here's the first thing which actually kept us busy for a while. It's what we call a Bell state. And it sort of starts the ball rolling. So here's a symbolic definition, which I'm not going to explain to you. Maybe I'm just going to compare it to the graphical one. Here is a graphical definition of what we call a Bell state or a Bell structure. So basically, it's a special box. It's a special box which has two outputs, no input, and which satisfies this somewhat weird equation. This is an identity. The reason I bet this is just to make like this sort of be at the same distance as this. It's not really essential because these things only hold on homotopy anyway. So it has this very weird equation. So here I've got this Bell state, and here I've got the thing upside down. So it's the corresponding Bell effect, you could say. And if I then first perform Bell state here, I've got another incoming system, and then I put the Bell effect there, I get basically an identity. That's what this action says. It's very simple. Like, just to show that this is basically the same thing, I'm just going to make a little comparison. So I start with a system A, I join something here. You see, I'm adjoining something. This is the adjoining bit. So then I end up with three systems. Then I apply something to the two first ones. This is the applying to the two first ones. And then you see I throw away nothing and I end up with A and everything is equal to the identity. So just to say that this picture really is like equivalent to some symbolic expression, which obviously looks slightly less tangible. Now, this picture isn't that clear yet. It's like a little bit weird, but now I'm going to change my representation. Like instead of representing this guy, because it's a very special guy by just a big triangle, I'm going to represent him by these little cups of caps, just to stress that it's special. And I'm actually going to throw the triangles away. And now you see that actually this law was nothing that you've got a piece of rope and you can sort of stretch it. It's pure, like you got the wire, and like this wire, it doesn't really matter how I throw it here, you know? It does the same thing. Like the electricity keeps on coming. However, I sort of bend it and stuff.
Are you going to explain why the diagram corresponds to what we think of as the Bell state?
Right, yes. So I'm just going to just do algebra first with this, and then I'll give examples of this. Because there's a lot of yeah. So now we're going to start proving things, just using this bit of algebra. So this, yeah?
Just a clarification. I know what a Bell state is, at least in the conventional thing. Here you've labeled this Bell structure. At a formal level, what is a, quote, Bell structure, unquote?
This is one. A structure in maths is some set with something else. Right? So here I've got an element, an object A, together with something extra, and that's this bit. So to write it symbolically, a structure is some object A together with something extra. In the same way that a group is a set with multiplication. That's why I call it
set A with a map.
It's not a set yet. It's not necessarily a set. It's a label. It's an abstract. It's an abstract structure.
Okay.
Yeah. Like you would probably find it easier. Like I can tell you what a monoid is. This might make some sense. This is not really that important. But a monoid is a group without inverses, would be a set A together with an operation from A across A to A, right? And this is your group multiplication. So you see, this is just a slight variation on the same thing, with the difference that I'm not specifying what A is. I'm just saying there is this guy and he satisfies this. He has to satisfy that. So that's my equation of constraint. In the same way that in groups you say associativity and stuff like that. So that's how it works. Right, let me prove something. So I'm defining a new, so given such a box, I'm defining a new box, which now I sort of define this bigger box by giving it internal structure. It means like whenever I'm given a box F, and I put this wire there and that wire there, then I put a box which is like 180 degrees rotated as compared to F. You see, it's like this one and this, the big one, they're sort of 180 degrees rotated from each other. So 180 degrees rotation means that I actually added this guy and then I added this guy. What can we prove from this? So this is definition. And I claim I can already prove something. So I adjoin this two things there. I just now rewrite the whole thing without the internal structure. It's just like rewriting. And then I use my laws that this is actually equal to the identity and that this is actually equal to the identity to turn this one into this and to turn this one into this. And what you see now is that there is a rule that you can take this box and sort of slide it along these wires. You see? That's why I chose this 180 degree rotation. Because that's actually how it looks like, as if you can just slide. So everything just stays very topologically. I can just, these bell states, you can slide boxes around them. That's what this lemma tells me. I just get it from the algebra, from the simple. So the thing which I'm using is this equation. Right. So basically, we're here now. So given any box like this, there are now three different boxes. One which was the adjoint, which was just flipping upside down. Then this guy, which I'm going to call the transpose, which is 180 degree rotation. And then if you compose this operation with this operation, you of course end up here. And now if you go looking for linear maps, what these guys do, whenever you use really belt states for these cups and these caps, then it turns out that one is indeed the transpose and the other means like conjugation of matrices. Like you just conjugate all the entries. That's what you get in Hilbert spaces. So I'll just have to write down. So in Hilbert spaces, so this guy is basically just the sum over a pair of base vectors. That's what it is always. And you can show that everybody knows that this is true because this is why teleportation works. Alice and Bob share the bell state, and then Alice does this bell measurement. So I'll show you this now, and then you're going to immediately see why this is actually true. So consider this equality. You see, this is an equation, because I can sort of slide this guy there, and then he ends up there. Now, I already defined unitarity, saying something is unitary. If you compose it with its adjoint, then you get identity. And so let's pick F to be unitary. Let's go. Okay? And now we adjoin Alice and Bob. And you get this sort of picture. So, and this quantum teleportation. How does it work? Well, you got Alice, you got Bob. Alice and Bob share a bell state, right? Then Alice performs a certain measurement. So it's a bipartite measurement, so it has two inputs. Now, a measurement, of course, is a non-deterministic process. So there is some variable here. And for different values of F, you got different projectors in your spectra. And if then, so you see, there is this thing which there is this bijective correspondence. There is this bijective correspondence. If I've got an entangled state, then I can also. So this is an arbitrary entangled state written out in a basis, right? I can always look at this matrix. And this is the matrix of some linear map. So there's a bijective correspondence between vectors of a tensor product of two Hilbert spaces and linear maps between these two Hilbert spaces. So it's just like a simple way of rewriting things. And so that's what is used here. You are representing this effect, which is like a bra corresponding to an element of a tensor product of two Hilbert spaces by a linear map. And this is, and but the wiring, this is how the wires do that for you. This is how the wires do that for you. And so, and that's actually how the unitary correction, which is done here, then directly relates to the sort of measurement you have to use there. And of course, teleportation involves,
Can I ask, in teleportation, Alice has to send a classical message to
Yes, so the classical message is, the classical message is the fact that Bob doesn't know in advance which F he has to apply. So this F has to be the same as this F, otherwise it doesn't work. So Alice has to say to Bob which one this F is. She can't decide on F because there is a full spectrum of possible measurement outcomes. And depending on the measurement outcome, you get a different F.
But how is that temporal structure imposed in this framework?
So, so the next step of my structure will be to make this communication explicit. At the moment, it's still implicit. The classical communication means that this thing is the same as this thing. That's a classical communication. Of course, it's very unsatisfactory that you don't see a wire. So the next step is actually to make this wire explicit. That will be the second part of my talk. But so the classical communication in this picture is the implicit, is the fact that these two things have to be the same.
Can you put any F there and that equation holds?
Yeah, this equation holds for anything. It doesn't depend on any dimension or anything.
Because teleportation, there's a specific...
Right. So that's the second thing which is not at all part of the structure yet. What sort of Fs can I choose physically?
Here there's nothing.
It's not yet part of the structure. So it's good that I got these two questions because so I'm going to swap this one for reasons of time. So people want to see some examples. So like I said, in the case of Hilbert spaces, you take the Bell state for these guys. But the same equation holds not just in the world of linear maps, but it also holds in the world of relations. If you look, you, instead of taking Hilbert spaces as your systems and linear maps as your processes, you can take sets as your systems and relations of your processes, and instead of taking the tensor, you can take a Cartesian product, and then these pictures still work perfectly, it turns out. And there are even much weirder categories. I don't know whether people know from cobordisms or something like that. These are categories of manifolds, which John Bias likes to talk a lot about. They also have this structure. So this equation holds there, too. So there's some other stuff you can prove. So you can prove no cloning and no broadcasting at this level of language. And there is an amazing theorem which has been proven again by this guy called Peter Selinger, which despite the fact that there are many different mathematical structures which form categories which obey these sort of laws, any matrix calculus does this for you. Any kind of matrix calculus in any crazy centering of whatever you want works for this. But still there is something really special about Hilbert spaces. With respect to the spread structure, it turns out, as the guy shows, that an equational statement holds between linear maps, if and only if it holds in this picture language. An equational statement which is expressible in this language, which is a fact. And this only works for Hilbert spaces. This doesn't work for relations or anything like that. For the relations, you get more equational statements for free. So there's something very special about Hilbert spaces still in this. Okay, so now what is missing? First question I got, can classical data be represented in pictures? Second question I got, which physical operations can be fully implemented? So these were the two questions I got, and I need to answer them now formally. I find this really clever of myself. So quantum structures three, we're going to talk about observables. So what we know is that quantum data cannot be copied nor deleted. Classical data can be copied and deleted. These are just facts we know for quantum information. We're going to treat one as a non-feature and the other one as a feature. Right? So basically what we're going to say is classical data is something which comes with a copying operation and with a deleting operation. So in the same way that I had sort of a Bell structure, like remember a Bell structure, it's something which comes with some extra bits. Now I have observables or observable structures, something which comes with observables. And the observable structure is specification of what actually can be copied and deleted. You'll see how formally this works. So I don't want to go into too much detail, but there's a bunch of actions you have to assume to make this thing work. So here's, I'm not going to explain these actions because of lack of time. I'm not going to use them anyway later. So here are a bunch of actions. Next Tuesday I give a talk in the foundation seminar, and I'm going to talk in much more detail about like measurement and classical data and how you represent this than I'll do here. So that this is the key theorem, that if you look at linear maps, every pair of guys like this, which end up satisfying these algebraic axioms, which you can formulate, it's called like, they are they're commutative Dagger-Frobenius comonoids. That's like the technical term. So mathematicians who do this sort of math, they know what this is, if I just say these words. This is like something which is called Frobenius law. So these guys which satisfy this in for linear maps exactly correspond to orthonormal bases. So basically what I've got here is a bunch of pictorial elements together with a bunch of pictorial rules, which in the case of Hilbert spaces exactly correspond to picking a basis. So for each choice of those guys here, such that they satisfy these rules, you pick out an orthonormal basis in your Hilbert space. So this is a highly non-trivial theorem to prove, by the way, this one. But it just works. Now, like how does this work? And now you're going to understand better what's happening. Well, this first copying map, what it does is it copies the basis vectors. And it uniformly deletes them. And you can see very easy that if you take something which copies the basis vector, a linear map like that, from one Hilbert space to two Hilbert spaces, that you can actually recover the basis vectors from it. Because the only things which are copied are, of course, the basis vector. Everything else becomes an entangled state. So it encodes a basis. Now, the whole trivial part about this theorem is that each thing which satisfies these axioms is of this form. So actually encodes the basis. And so this is the sort of graphical trait, this is the sort of object we're going to use to encode classical data and classical communication. However, this of course looks horrible as a set of axioms to carry around. And yeah?
I'm just wondering, what exactly is M Hill?
Didn't I define? This means Hilbert spaces and linear maps, finite dimensional.
As a category?
Yeah. Okay. And that's the product. I should have said that, forgot to say that. Yeah. So that's it. Right. So let's keep that. All right, spires. We talked already about hooking, now it's time for spires. Like, what was nice about all this business with these cups and these caps is that they're very easy to manipulate and it's very easy to reason into them. And what I just gave you was a bunch of ugly rules, and I then claimed, yeah, we got some representation theorem. For if you satisfy these rules, and you correspond to an orthonormal basis. But it's not gonna, it doesn't seem to satisfy the nice flavor of making your computations easier. Well, it turns out you can prove the following, that if you now rewrite this box by a dot with one input and two outputs, and this guy by a dot with only one input, and whenever you make this totally crazy notational convention that when in your picture this configuration occurred, you rewrite it as a spire, then you can basically show that each connected network of these dot subtype figures, each connected network is always equal to such a spire. So there is very little degrees of freedoms in these networks, just the number of inputs and the number of outputs. And this gives you a very simple graphical rewrite system for reasoning about this classical information. Here is a new definition of an observable. Observable in terms of spires. So an observable, rather than just giving this copying operation and this deleting operation, what I'm giving now is I'm giving a bunch of spires. Oops, I'm missing this one. Right. I'm giving these bunch of spiders with N inputs and M outputs, and whenever two spiders meet each other, they become a single spider. It's like the opposite of what spiders usually do, they reproduce. Here they give the sort of annihilate, so they sort of. And this is my new graphical principle. Mm-hmm. And the real magic of it is that you might not see this, but this actually refines the idea of yanking a wire. Look, you remember this one? A cap and a cup can be straightened. You see, this is the special case of some special spires. So this structure is actually refines the previous structure I was talking about. It's not a completely different thing. It's finer and gives you a lot more reasoning power. So examples in Hilbert spaces. they arise from picking a base, and just the spider base. So this is the spider from 1 to 2, it just copies the bases. Again, in the category of relations, such guys exist. I'm not going to talk, but we found that, well, no, I'm not going to say this. Ask me again about spiders in relation if you want to. And again, in these categories, which John Bias likes to talk about, this sort of structures live there too. So you can think of them as bases in that sort of categories if you want to. They look like trousers for these manifolds, trousers, pair of trousers. So we know, so I'm not going to specify the sort of thing we know about this structure. I'm going to maybe talk about that in the foundation start next week. So I want to give some specific applications. And actually, for these applications, we need to go one step more. It's not a surprise that if you want to have really penetrate the quantum mechanical structure, that something like complementarity has to kick in. Complementary observables. You don't do a lot of quantum mechanics if you don't have complementary observables. So now we're talking about, we will be doing, huh? So we assume we've got spiders, and I'm going to talk now about families of spiders. There's the red family of spiders, and there's the green family of spiders. And they're complementary. They're complementary. So what we're trying to going to figure out is, how do red spiders and green spiders interact? We know that one green spider, when it meets another green spider, they sort of fuse. Same goes for red spiders. What does happen if a green spider meets a red spider? And that's what's called complementarity. Right. So I'm going to give two definitions. If I have a certain state, and I've got one of these copying operations associated to a spider, and we have this equation statement that it's sort of that the state just passes through. Basically, the state is copied. The state is copied by this thing. You see, I start with one and I get two. Then we call it an eigenstate. Right? This is actually how we started to build this copying operation. You say this copying operation copies the basis vector. So, or basis vector or eigenstate, the same thing. So we define now abstractly what it means to be a basis vector or an eigenstate.
Eigenstate of what?
Of the black dot. The black dot is sort of the copying operation leading on the spider family or whatever you want. So they have spiders and eigenstates. Spiders also have unbiased states. I'm not going to go too much into detail in the conceptual significance. I'm just going to say it's possible to define a concept, which is if you take again this dot and you have a state, which if you plug in one here and there and you get a single dot, then we call it an unbiased state. An unbiased state. And then you can prove the following theorem. So here, about green spiders meaning red spiders. So I'm proving a theorem here in any kind of abstract theory. And the theorem is, with the definition that two observables are complementary, if the eigenstates for one are unbiased for the other, because that's what's the case in Hilbert space, that's what biased means. Eigenstates of one observable are unbiased for the other. Then we show that they are complementary if and only if. This is if and only if. In any abstract theory, this little picture holds. So if green spider meets a red spider, they sort of touch each other, and then they don't touch anymore. They don't like each other. Yeah?
I don't have an interpretation in my head for a circle with a line going up out of it. What?
These are just the same things as well. Let me go over here. Okay. This is one upside down.
So it's a preparation of a state in.
So purely technically, for the 0-1 basis, if I start with the 0-1 basis, so each of these spiders corresponds with a basis, then this would be the plus state. Because the plus state uniformly deletes them. If I make in the product of the plus state with each of these, I get the same number. So this is the plus state in that case.
The plus state is the circle with the line coming down.
I put this upside down. That's the plus state, right? So.
So does that picture mean you create something and then you do something with it?
What the picture means, it's a bit funny because a lot of these structures, if you see them as physical processes which you rewrite, it doesn't really make sense. Because you're sort of doing, the rewrite rules don't really preserve causality and all of these guys, these things. What it respects, it just respects that the way you read it is, if you make this configuration, which would be you start with something, you copy it, this is something, this thing has appeared in quantum information literature as fusion. They use it to make cluster states and stuff like that. So that this is basically the same thing. So it's the adjoint of this copying operation. So it says that doing this process is the same as just like having this effect and then after that this preparation. So that's what it means. But the funny, so this theorem is proved abstractly. Of course, it holds in Hilbert spaces. It holds in, this law holds for any two complementary observables in Hilbert space. It holds. It does. But you prove it actually in a much more general way. It just follows from these two definitions, which of course in Hilbert spaces correspond with the usual notions. Right. To at least get one of my examples done. Okay, phases. So this is not a new, you see, before I said always introduce new bits of structure. I said first I introduced these Bell states, then bases, then a pair of complementary observables. And now there is not sort of new structure. The reason is that phases we get free, because all we have. So it turns out that the unbiased states of an observable always constitute an abelian group. This is just true for general reasons. For everything I've told so far, I defined what unbiased states were for dot. If you look at all of theirs, they always constitute an abelian group. So, and then there is a and actually what you can do is, you can decorate, so I'm going to denote such an unbiased state by a phase label, by alpha. And you can now actually decorate all these spiders with this phase data. It turns out that it doesn't really matter whether you plug such phase state in any of these legs. It doesn't really matter. It's always the same thing. And you just put it here. And now when a spider with an alpha phase meets a spider with beta phase, they just add their phases. See, it's a very simple graphical principle. So now we've got decorated spiders. So if they sort of blend or whatever they do, they sort of add their genes. Think of they're carrying genes. And so there is something to these spiders. They add their genes. Right, so here is an example. So now concretely in Hilbert space, if I take this basis, then this would be my phase states. And of course, this would be my phase gates. So you see, I'm getting closer to circuitry now. And these phases are just living here of the block sphere. If I change color, then I could, for example, take this basis, the x basis, which is complementary to the z basis, and now my phases live here. Right? And the theorem you can now actually show is that every linear map, I'm writing now category F Hill, that's not just all Hilbert spaces as objects, but these are the Hilbert spaces which are powers of qubits. So qubits do something. So they can be expressed in nothing but the language of like these decorated spiders. You can write down any linear map. You can come up with from n qubits to n qubits. So this language is a complete language now. Remember that these phases were actually something which arised from abstract reasons. It was this group which you got, this group structure which I told you get for free just from this observable structure. And so I just want to go quickly now to at least get one of my applications done. So I just wrote down here, this for example, how a W state looks in this language for those people who know what it is. So, right. So it turns out by picking the green dot and the red dot, like I just said, this corresponds to the Z observable, this corresponds to the X observable, that the C not gate arises as this. So whenever I have this, I can actually easily show that this is the same as this. And therefore, I denote it like this. You see, I'm trying to now blend this notation into certain notation a bit more. And this is my C not gate or CX gate, if you want to, with this matrix. Why is it the CX gate? Well, we can actually show this with our spider rules. If I plug in one of these eigenstates here, and you know, green, the idea of complementarity is one color Actually, one color is eigenstates for the other color. So this guy is copied. So it gets here and there. We use the spider rule, and now that you see that the effect of this thing, when you plug in either a zero or one, is if there is a zero, it does nothing. If there is a one, it turns out to be the NOT gate. So the sort of this bit of what a NOT gate does is already in this. Yeah, and we might go. So it's not really important. So what do you get if you compose two of these? I'm just going to show that they are unitary. So if you compose them, you get the identity. Well, they blend together. There's a spider rule. And now you see this configuration. Remember that it's complementarity. It means it's gone. So it's identity. So that's how you're now actually computing these. Then you can do a lot more computation. So I want to give one. The last example will be an example of measurement-based quantum computing. So for this example, it makes sense to actually introduce a new graphical element, which I'm going to call the color changer. The color changer is something that, if you plug it in all the legs of a spider, it changes the color of it. So it's just some concept term. Of course, this corresponds to the Hadamard gate in the case of the two observables I define. Oh, man. All right, I'll skip this. So I told you what a CNOT gate is. It turns out that this is a CZ gate. So you take two green ones with an H in the middle. And now look at this configuration. This configuration means we start with a bunch of plus states. I said that these guys are plus states. We apply some CZs to it. So you know that this actually gives you a cluster state. People who know measurement-based computation know this, how you produce a cluster state. And now we're going to apply some effects to it. This is measurement along alpha, this is measurement along beta, measurement along gamma, some other measurement. And I'm claiming that this shows that measurement-based quantum computing is universal for single qubit gates. Why? I'm just going to. So this is a big cluster state prepared by applying a bunch of CZ gates. So the spiders means all the green dots go together and all the alpha gates so are added up. So we start with this, and now we have to be quick. You see? All this comes together, all this comes together, all this comes together, and all this comes together. Color changes, of course, they annihilate each other, and these two will change the color of beta. So what you get is the Euler angle decomposition of any arbitrary one qubit unit V. This is the Euler angle decomposition of one qubit unit V here. So these are the steps. So we start with a bunch of states, a bunch of CZ gates, and a bunch of measurements along a bunch of angles. That's the computation, that this is one qubit unitary using the spider logic. So other things in this domain is like we can compute quantum Fourier transform. There's a bunch of stuff now going on graph states. But the nicest thing is that some guys have actually turned all this reasoning into a piece of software. So we have this tool called Quantumatic, which basically automatically does all these rewrites for you. They're still developing and enriching it, but the idea is that ultimately you would have a tool which proves theorems for you using this underlying logic. Because this is something you can very easily implement in a computer, because all the elements I was talking about are discrete. There's no continuous stuff going on here. It's all discrete. So you can completely automate this. This also shows that we're actually dealing with real logic, because you can, there is like a, how do you call it? There is like a rewrite scheme, which is actually what a logic does for you. It does deduction. So this is actually all these rewrites graphically are real logical deduction. And this software implements really this logic into something which, a computer, which actually does the reasoning for you. So this guy, which has been working on, he comes, I think, on the 10th or the 11th, and he'll stay for a month or something. So I wanted to say something about non-locality, but I'm out of time.
Questions? What is non-locality?
What is non-locality?
Just happen to have some prepared slides for this question.
So, maybe it's not locality, there is no local hidden variable theory, it's a technical definition. Some inequality is not satisfied, is another way to put it. GHZ theorem. which means that some correlations cannot be obtained, is again a negative statement. So the only other still is what it's not. But the question is, what is it? And that's what I was planning to answer.
What is the answer?
Right, okay. Thank you. Right. So, skip. So, I'll go very quickly on this. So, basically, I gave this definition of observable. You can similarly define what a GHZ state is in some pictorial language. Like here, you see a GHZ state is something which, if I swap two states in it, then I still get the same thing. And there are some other properties. This sort of relates GHZ state to Bell states, that if you act with a plus on it, you get actually a Bell state out of it. So these are just some behavioral rules of GHZ states, and then you can actually prove that technically they're in one-to-one correspondence with what we call observables. Like if you've got a basis, it defines the unique sort of GHZ state and vice versa. And so this is the abstract transcription of that. Hence, given that we have GHZ state, we can talk about GHZ correlations, meaning you apply some effects to two elements in your GHZ state, and you get a third element. And then we define something which is called mutually unbiased theories, and these are special theories in which the states are eigenstates or unbiased states for all observables. There are very well-known examples, stabilizer qubit theory, right? And also, that's the sub-theory of quantum mechanics, and then the big theorem says that in mutually unbiased theories, GHZ correlations are completely defined by the phase group, which it says that abelian groups classify non-local behavior. So certain properties of non-locality, everything, every sort of non-local behavior can have can be completely traced back to a family of abelian groups. And so we actually then looked to two simple examples of abelian groups, which are two four-element groups. And then you see that for the Z4 group, you get qubit stabilizer quantum theory. For the Z2 and C2, you get Rob-Stoy theory. So whatever sort of behaviors you can have in terms of non-locality, which is what sort of correlations will a GHZ state give you, can completely be traced back to the group. So the group structure is a non-locality. So this is non-locality, this is locality. Because this theory is not. I don't know. So there's a bunch of technicalities, but I'm not going to go into that. Anyway, there's a paper you can download on this. It's not on the archive, but you can download it. I think it's cool stuff.
Other questions?
I guess I have one more question. So
I'm out of slides.
Sorry?
I'm out of slides.
Somewhere in there, you basically constructed a picture for state preparation.
Right.
And then flipped it upside down to create for effects.
Yeah.
Have you thought about how to put Rake-Hilbert space into this formula? I mean, that's a natural thing to do in Hilbert space because of the Riesz theorem. But a lot of the fun stuff in continuous variables requires states that aren't states.
Right. So the thing where not a lot is known yet is continuous variables and infinite dimensions, because of we have this representation theorem for bases, but all the like orthonormal bases in terms of spiders, but it's finite dimensional. When you go infinite dimensional, your Bell states diverge. This guy diverges. So you can still retain most of your spiders, but you have to require that it needs a front leg and a back leg. And then the theory doesn't hold anymore. So your spiders are not in one-to-one correspondence anymore with orthonormal bases. So people are now, I've got a PhD student who knows a lot of functional analysis and stuff specifically. And that's an open problem. So it's an open problem, like infinite dimensional stuff.
What do you mean by divergence?
If you've got an infinite basis, then this thing is not
normalizing.
It's not a Hilbert, like the identity is not a Hilbert Schmidt map on an infinite dimensional Hilbert space. That's a problem. It's not normalizable. So you lose your in the category of infinite dimensional Hilbert space, you lose your cups on infinite dimensional objects. Because they are not Hilbert Schmidt.
Okay.
identities.
I mean, the entangled, not layer.
Yeah. So you can't have a maximal and maximally entangled state.
It's not in the Hilbert space.
So people have said that a way to understand is the dimension of Hilbert space by wondering the Elspeth.
Right.
And is that
So again, we don't know a lot about infinite dimensional, but so what did a result which one guy did prove is I have this observable structure which I set, and part of the definition is commutativity. It means if you take commutativity basically means that if you got one of the swapping operations and you swap the legs, you get the same. So if you drop this part of the definition, then these structures are exactly C-star algebras, a bit more general than Neumann algebras. But so this, the non-commutative guys here are exactly C-star algebras. So that sort of puts you a little bit in that direction, I think. We don't know a lot more there. But again, only finite dimensionally. So that's, again, a theorem you would like to generalize infinite dimensionally. Right. Now one of the reasons for Neumann very much believed in like these type 2 factors of certain von Neumann algebras, where because you need to have some way of computing probabilities. And this type of algebras, they gave you a canonical notion of trace so that you can compute probabilities. But in fact, we here have all, if you get these cups and these caps, you always have a notion of trace anyway. Because if you take such a cap and such a cup, an identity in between, and you put it in a box, this is exactly the Hilbert space trace. So you can always compute your probabilities. So that's at an abstract level of connection, I think, with those structures. Now, people who are doing representation theory, people like von Jones and all that, who are very much studying these sort of structures, they're using all this picture stuff. So it's not really a re-event and all that. We invented a version of it, but they're using a lot of these techniques in representation theory. So it's sort of popping up in a lot of areas of math and sort of stuff.
These upside down triangles, these triangles and upside down triangles, all the cups and the caps, are associated with maximally entangled states or effects.
Yeah.
So it seems like the maximally entangled states play a special role. I mean, is in this way of viewing things, could non-maximally entangled states sort of get a similar role?
They're sort of a consequence of it. If you got one of these, then any arbitrary Hilbert state can be written like this.
So that's the reason they play a special role.
They're sort of generating. Now, a priori, there is, so given you've got the category of Hilbert spaces and you want to define such a structure, because I call this a structure, I didn't call this a property. You can actually take a non-maximally entangled state. As long as this guy is non-singular, he basically gives you the same structure. For each of these, I just put here the inverse map, right? And so this guy and this guy together do satisfy this axiom, because these inverses annihilate each other. So it's not really that essential.